When I visited Vietnam at the end of 1947, things were turbulent and disturbed. In a convoy in which I was traveling outside of Saigon, an ambush attack was made and 3 passengers in the convoy were killed. On a trip for pressmen organized by the French army in the northern part of Indochina, on which I was invited to participate, but unfortunately couldn't, or fortunately couldn't, because of the time factor, one correspondent came back with a bullet hole through his shoulder, and 2 other cars were attacked. This time, going back into the same area, I found some changes, but not as many as one would have liked. It was possible this time to sit in Saigon at the Continental Hotel and not hear mortars going off at the edge of town most of every night. I was told it was possible to take the road that I had taken safely. I didn't try it. But the air, the mood in Saigon was certainly not comfortable. A matter of some days after my trip, that was demonstrated by the riots that occurred when the American naval personnel got ashore on what was described as a goodwill mission. I went on up into the hills of northern Indochina, Tonkin, just opposite the China frontier, and found there that in order to move out, even to see the French forts, it was necessary to get into a jeep, which was preceded by an armored car that was supposed to take care of landmines, and then by a scout car, and followed by a weapons carrier that was filled with French Foreign Legion who were supposed to do all this. I think it looked a little like a Bogest movie. With all of this activity, there were casualties. We went and visited the local military cemetery, and there was, appeared to me to have been about 1 or 2 new graves per week over the preceding months. In one area, occupied by Tho tribesmen rather than by Vietnamese, the Tho who live on both sides of the China-Indochina border, many of them are friendly to the French and are under French control. In that area, there were 9 French forts to protect the valley that held 9,000 people. The French were not making a pretense of holding the roads that they had invited me to tour in 1947. They had given up those roads and were feeding the towns at the end of the road by airdrops. The military position, I thought, was not much better than in 1947, even though areas in the Red River Valley in Tonkin had been cleared, and areas in the south, Cochin China, had been cleared. Of the 150,000 French-commanded troops there, about a third were local troops with French officers. About a third were Foreign Legion, with all of the flavor of the Foreign Legion. One man turned out to be the best French cook that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting professionally. Another was apparently formerly a tightrope walker in the circus and demonstrated his art for us. The rest of the group was French infantry and marines and other soldiers. The boys were not discouraged. They were in good mood, I thought. But to an outsider returning after 2.5 years, the impressive thing was that they didn't cover a great deal more territory than they had in 1947. It's necessary in Indochina, in Vietnam, to have an army if any part of the country is to be kept clear of the Viet Minh regime of Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh, of course, has had long communist contacts. He is today, I think, by all the evidence that one can get, completely allied with the Peking regime of Mao Zedong and with Moscow. The story, the French, of course, have killed him off 4 times, but he still keeps reported being alive. But there is very, not good evidence, but some evidence that perhaps he is not so well as he once was. And there are suggestions that power has been transferred to a subordinate, Nguyen Van Giap, who is very clearly and definitely communist. I think there is no question in trying to assess the Vietnam picture that the Ho Chi Minh forces today are under communist leadership and communist control. I don't mean that all supporters of Ho Chi Minh are communists, because Ho Chi Minh has led what is in part a nationalist movement. It seemed to me that among the people of the country that I met along the way, the personal bitterness of the local Asian against the European was more vindictive, more sharp in Vietnam than it was in the areas which had been ruled by the British or by the Dutch or by the Americans. There are reasons for this that go into history. But because that situation is true, if it is true, and I think so, Ho Chi Minh can get a lot of supporters just by saying that he is definitely, unquestionably, anti-French. What's on the other side of the picture? Within the area, which is patrolled and controlled by the French army, there is now the government of Bao Dai, which has been set up by arrangement with France and which has been recognized by the United States, Great Britain, some other European countries, and Thailand. Bao Dai, the former emperor of Annam, is accused locally of being a puppet of the French. He's a restive puppet, I think, if he's a puppet. 3 days ago, word came from a source, from a person whose judgment I value, that he or someone around him is considering the possibility of flight, of just getting out of what looks like an impossible situation. I can't evaluate that bit of information. If it should happen, of course, now, 2 days after the United States government has agreed that it would give more aid to the French for Indochina, it would further complicate an already incredibly complicated situation. A number of people support Bao Dai. So far as I could find out, he has the support of a fairly large segment of the quite important local Catholic community, of at least part of a sect, fairly numerous sect called the Cao Daiist sect. Of the elements in Vietnam life which had gone along fairly comfortably with the French regime, as you know, French colonial policy has been to include many of the elite of the local group within the confines of French culture and to make French citizens of them. This group is with Bao Dai. And extraneous groups in other categories. It was hoped that when the United States and Britain recognized Bao Dai, there would be a great transmigration of loyalty from Ho Chi Minh to Bao Dai. I'm afraid that there's been a trickle rather than a large stream. There's one other very important group in Indochina who I think may hold the key to what is likely to happen. Those are the fence sitters. They don't like Ho Chi Minh. They don't like him partly because he's a communist or is in communist control and they are not. They don't like him even more because he's associated with the Chinese. And even while I was in Vietnam this time, the Vietnamese were celebrating a victory that they had won over the Chinese sometime during the 10th century after Christ. The Vietnamese don't like the Chinese also because of experiences they had during the Chinese occupation after this last war in 1945 and 46. So a great many people have been lost to Ho Chi Minh because of his connections with the Chinese. Those same people don't like Bao Dai because they do feel he's a puppet. They argue that if he were to help him now, if they were to help him now, they would be serving France. One man to whom I was taken by a somewhat devious route, because people don't speak out with complete freedom in Vietnam these days. Well, this man explained that he certainly would like to oppose Ho Chi Minh, but he wanted to see Bao Dai get farther away from the French before he could support Bao Dai. He said, can't you get the French out of here? And then if you have to support a man like Bao Dai, let the United States support Bao Dai, and at least we could cooperate with somebody without cooperating with the French. That's the depth, it seemed to me, of the personal feeling there. I don't think that our policy has moved in that direction up to the present time. The question of how to get the fence sitters to come in with any government apart from the communist supported government is the most difficult, complicated question that we face today. And that is the problem that I'm sure Secretary Acheson has been wrestling with in Paris. It's the problem of how you meet communism in a field where it is already acting in the interests of the people concerned. Again, there seems no way to put in great sums of American money and make these people believe they should be pro-American. They don't like it that way. The old order was a white man's order, and that order is shattered, it's broken. There is no way that these people of the area can be persuaded that a new white man's order should come in. The new order, independence, is just not enough. Because a country has become independent doesn't mean that it is immediately strong and firm on its feet and ready to meet the problems of this world. The difficulties of proceeding in Indochina at the present time are so grave and so complex that I can fully understand how Washington has hesitated, how it has started in one direction and withdrawn and then gone off in another direction, and how now it seems to be going ahead with considerable trepidation in a policy of supporting the French. An outside observer rather feels that a policy of supporting the French in Indochina will put us in a position infinitely more difficult than was our position in trying to support the Kuomintang at a time when the Kuomintang appeared to have lost a great deal of public support in China. I'd like to turn for a little bit to the area adjacent to Southeast Asia, because it's not a question of just Southeast Asia and the United States. It's a question of the whole of Asia and the relations within Asia. Pakistan and India play a great role in this whole Asian picture. I hope that you can see Pakistan marked up here and down here, and then India, of course, in here and right up there at the edge. The Prime Minister of Pakistan is in this country now, of course, seeking to assure the American public that investment opportunities are very considerable in Pakistan. As a matter of fact, Pakistan has been extraordinarily lucky since its foundation in 1947. And that luck has enabled it to be in a position today rather farther ahead than was expected at the time it was founded. Pakistan has had a surplus of food in the western part. In fact, wheat was running out of the ears of the government, if I may say so, this year, at a time when India, its neighbor, was short of wheat, and a trade barrier made it impossible to move wheat across that new three-year-old line. Because Pakistan people had lots of food, they said, Pakistan is good. We never had food in such quantity and at such low prices under British rule. Pakistan people in the West have also had a good deal of cloth. They've been able to get gasoline. And they have been surprised at the purely personal benefits that Pakistan has brought to them. In addition, there is in Pakistan today a fervor of unity. There has been this since Pakistan was founded, which is based largely in the same psychological impulses that brought the creation of Pakistan. Pakistan was to be a country where the Muslims of India could have their homeland. The Muslims of India got their homeland. Relations after independence, after the partitioning of India, continued to be bad, so that the Muslims who were in Pakistan have had a feeling of unity owing to what might be called, described as a psychosis in respect to the attitude toward India. Relations with India have so dominated thinking in Pakistan that I believe the recent pact between Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan of Pakistan and Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru of India is of double and treble and multiple importance. Because if it's true, as the Indian embassy people are saying this week, and as Prime Minister Liaquat Ali himself is saying, that relations have been fundamentally changed by these agreements, and then there is indeed in prospect a new era in both Pakistan and India. Pakistan has been affected by the dislocation of trade which came about as a result of a disagreement on the value of the two currencies of India and Pakistan. When the British pound was devalued last September, of course, India devalued its rupee at the same rate, whereas Pakistan decided to hold the value of its rupee at the old rate against the US dollar. This resulted in lack of parity between India and Pakistan, and such a chaotic condition in respect to balance of payments between the two that when India refused to recognize the new rate, the new higher rate of the Pakistan rupee, and Pakistan refused to devalue its rupee to meet the Indian currency. All trade stopped. The major issue on the Pakistan side, however, has been the question of Kashmir. Indeed, the United Nations has heard so much about Kashmir that one man confessed that he wished that there never had been such a place as Kashmir. I was up on the Khyber Pass talking to some of the Pathan Maliks, the tribesmen who had gone into Kashmir in 1947. Asked them how they felt about things now.
London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. This week, we bring you the voices of Wales from the Royal Eisteddfod. We span 7 counties from London to Devonshire by automobile, and we examine a recent pronouncement of our government on the burning question of rearmament. And that matter of major concern to us, to yourselves, and to the world should properly come first. The British government, like other governments of the Atlantic Treaty powers, recently answered the pertinent question put to each of them by Washington, what are your proposals in the matter of increasing your defences? And the British memorandum in reply has stated that over the next 3 years, Great Britain will spend on additional defensive armament a sum approaching $10,000 million. $10 billion, as you would say. Well, it's recognized here, of course, that American assistance is vital to this new and vastly augmented defense program, and it's not possible to assess its effect until the full extent of American help is known. But some of the probable repercussions can be foreseen, and these are discussed for us now by our special contributor, Roland Fox.
It's evident from the memorandum that the attitude adopted by the government was that, so far as this country is concerned, the immediate problem is one of equipment shortage rather than manpower shortage. We have a substantial reserve of trained manpower, 1 million national servicemen, and the men trained in the last war, so that the manpower position is regarded as considerably better than it was in the years immediately preceding the last war. So the expert study which the government put in hand on receipt of the American request towards the end of last month was directed principally towards ways and means of increasing military equipment. As a result of this approach, it can be concluded that by far the biggest proportion of the total bill now proposed would be spent on equipment. And a reliable estimate is that if the full program were operated, our output of defense equipment and stores would be at least double what it is today. In that case, the impact on industry and on the country's investment program must be considerable. The extent of American assistance would obviously have a great effect on the intricate problem which would confront the government in London of working out how to spread the proposed new burden between investments, home consumption, and exports. Figures available in London enable some comparison to be made between the respective positions of the United Kingdom and the United States. According to these, our unemployment figure is 1.5%, and 3% of the working population are in the armed forces. America is said to have 5% unemployment, and a figure for June of 2% of the working population in the armed forces. In this country, we have an average working week of 45 hours, compared with America's 40 hours. And America's national income is estimated at 8 times the size of this country's at present rates of exchange. There's no doubt that the proposed new program is very formidable, and it's estimated here in London that, excepting for the first year after the war, it would involve us in the highest rate of expenditure on armaments that the country has ever known in peacetime.
Rearmament or not, and world crises notwithstanding, Wales remains, as she always has been, a land of poetry and song. And her music matches the mood of her black, craggy mountains, her foaming, rocky rivers, her rugged coasts, and the dark greenness of her deep, winding valleys. The Welsh Eisteddfods have long been the classic scenes of contests between mass choirs, contests in which vast audiences are swept into voice with them, all Wales a sea of song. The Royal Eisteddfod at Caer Philly is in full swing right now. And a taste of it is brought to us by our Welsh reporter, Griffith Jones, who set out for Caer Philly by train.
The Eisteddfod had started even on the British railways. Some young men in the next compartment were singing a dim tune in harmony. Next to me, a bearded pard, who at least looked like a bard, was reciting a poem in resonant Welsh. At every station, our Eisteddfod forces were augmented. A laughing girl was bringing her harp, with much male help. Fiddles and trombones mingled with mackintoshes and umbrellas on the luggage racks of the railway compartments. And when I reached Caerphilly and the Great Pavilion, I heard first a Welsh hymn sung during the official Eisteddfod opening. This was the great day of the bands. In the surrounding hills, several brass bands were practicing even before breakfast. Across the steep, narrow streets, everywhere, banners and streamers greeted you. Voices like quicksilver added to the greetings. There's always one special word that captivated the ear, the word croeso, and the Welsh mean it too, welcome. Before I had walked 50 yards, I was halted by an effusive, "How are you since last year?" In Welsh, of course. It was Mr. Jones from Penmynmawr. 100 yards down the road, Mrs. Jones from Fishtop took me warmly by the hand. Further on, there were Mr. Jones from Iberdan, Nigeria, and Mr. Jones from Mount Carmel, Pennsylvania, waiting nostalgically. All day long, every day, it will be like that. It's like being a member of the royal family on a handshaking tour. Indeed, every Jones and every Williams is a Prince of Wales this week.
The music of Merry England brings us back over the Welsh border, right back to London, in fact. But only for a moment, since we thought you'd like to hear of just one westward journey that waits to charm the traveller by road. It wasn't so very different in the old coaching days, but the tarmac roads of today, even the narrow ones, they're graded and dust-free, and they roll silently beneath your eagerly cruising motor car. From London to Torquay on the southwest coast of Devon, well, 200 miles perhaps, and Sheila Stewart has brought us a tourist's eye view.
It was evening when I left London, having decided to cover as much as possible of my 200-mile drive before dark. On the heathlands of Surrey, the heather was a mist of purple in the evening sunlight. But by the time I reached Salisbury Plain, the light was fading. On my right, where the sun had set, there was still a red glow in the sky. And on the left, a full moon like a golden guinea was rising out of the mist. The great plain stretched away on each side, mile upon rolling mile of it, mysterious and somehow eerie in the darkening evening. And silhouetted against the sky was the grey stone pile of the ancient Druid temple, Stonehenge. You know, they say that if you stand on Stonehenge at midnight when the moon is full, you'll see the Druids conducting their religious rites. And looking around me that evening, well, it looked quite possible. At least, I wasn't prepared to try. Well, now it was time to find somewhere to sleep for the night. And I found it in the little country town of Gillingham in Dorset. Let no one tell you that English country hotels are bad, while there are still places like the Phoenix and people like the Joneses to run them. Mine host was standing outside as I drove up, and he really lived up to that honorable old title. I was welcomed, fed, though it was long past the normal dinner hour, and shown into a comfortable little room where the furniture shone with polish and the sheets were scented with lavender. And so, after a good night's sleep, a magnificent breakfast, and many promises to return, and I will too, I was on my way again, through the West Country, where fields of golden wheat rippled in the breeze, where the grass in the valleys is almost unbelievably lush and green, where little white cottages with thatched roofs nestle in the villages, and the narrow roads wind between the hedges, starred with wildflowers, and where life is as peaceful and as slow as the soft West Country speech of the folk who live there. And so, to my journey's end, Torquay, that quaint seaside town, almost tropical with its palm trees on the waterfront and the white houses and hotels in tiers built into the steep hillsides. Yes, if you want to see beauty and a great variety of beauty crammed into a small space, travel through the English countryside in all the glory of high summer. It takes a bit of beating.
And now for our postscript from guest London columnist MacDonald Hastings. Mac.
The other day, an American friend of mine asked me why we British aren't doing more about the communist aggression in Korea. Well, I hope that Roland Fox's report in this London column on the vast new rearmament program that we're undertaking will settle any fears that you may have on your side that Britain doesn't mean business. It's true that in the face of the immediate challenge in Korea, we have so far only been able to send a token force. But the explanation for that is very easily given. Britain is already involved in a less spectacular but equally serious military campaign against communist-inspired guerrilla forces in Malaya. We are also providing the garrison for Hong Kong. In short, we are already deeply committed to the guarding of two vital strategic areas in the Far East. Never mind our responsibilities in the West. At present, our resources, like yours, are insufficient to meet our immediate military needs. Like you, we've planned in these past few years not for war, but for peace. But you need have no doubt that in the face of the challenge, we won't be with you all the way. And make no mistake that this huge rearmament program we're undertaking in Britain isn't going to hurt. The more so because in the past 6 months, there have been solid indications that at last, after the years of austerity, we have been recovering a peacetime economy. Rationing has been steadily decreasing. The shops are filled again with all the pleasant peacetime goods which since pre-war have been unobtainable. Every visitor from your side of the world has been remarking how much better things are here than they expected. Indeed, there has been every reason to hope that when martial aid ended in 1952, Britain would be standing firmly on her own feet again. Now, it's inevitable, I'm afraid, that luxury goods will be in short supply again. A rise in taxation levels here, already the highest in the world, looks unavoidable. It may be that some forms of rationing will have to be restored. Military service is already extended and reservists are being called back to the colours. If you ask me what people are saying about it, the general opinion, rightly or wrongly, is still that we shall manage to avoid a world war, but only at the terrible price of uprooting our national economy all over again. What we have to do now is to prove that we can do it without letting communism creep in through the back door. That, presumably, is Russia's hope. It won't be gratified. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a Radio Digest presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.